Rome is simultaneously very familiar, but at the same time, it's fabulously weird and alien. And that's the key to great science fiction. And I think that is, for us, is the fascination of Rome today.
Gibbon thought that Rome survived as long as it remained pagan. And he took the view that Christianity was the beginning of the end.
I think he has it exactly the wrong way around.
I think he's got it backwards.
Exactly the wrong way around.
A new age of empires is the dread phrase that gets sloshed around. Do you think that's overblown?
I think it's completely a possibility, because I think the idea of there being human rights is as fantastical as believing that the Lord Jesus rose from the dead on the third day.
Welcome to Socrates Dialogues. I'm Mary Harrington. So one of my favourite internet arguments over the last few years is the one where everybody decided to have a massive disagreement about how often it is that men really think about the Roman Empire. Do men think about the Roman Empire every day? Does this apply to all men? Today I am very fortunate to be joined by somebody who probably has thought about the Roman Empire more than most. Tom Holland, you are the author of numerous books, including a best-selling, award-winning trilogy about the Roman Empire. You are the co-host with Dominic Sandbrook of the world's most popular history podcast, The Rest is History. Welcome and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Tom, tell me, is it right? Is it true? Is it true? Do all men think about the Roman Empire every day? And if so, why? Why Rome?
I think men were supposed to think about it 10 times a day. And that seems to me very, very small number of times. I think about it a lot more than that. But I think also it was specifically American men.
Is it?
I think there may be reasons why Americans think about the Roman Empire more than, say, we do here
in
Britain.
Oh, say more. This is interesting.
Well, because I think America was consciously founded on the Roman model.
Mm.
So they had, they had a revolution against their king, chucked the king out, established a republic, founded a Senate, had a Capitol Hill, built a capital that, you know, clearly emulates an ape's imperial Rome. And so I think there's a kind of certain political shadow that is Roman hanging over the United States and always has done. So at the convention where they were kind of trying to work out what form of government they should have now that they'd got rid of the British monarchy, and Benjamin Franklin came out and they said, what's it going to be? And he famously said, a republic, if you can keep it. Because, of course, ultimately the Roman Republic collapsed and the Caesars built their autocracy amid the rubble of that republic. And so right from the very beginning, Americans have had two great worries. Mm-hmm. The first is that, like the Roman Empire, everything might fall and you end up with, you know, cattle feeding on grass amid the ruins of the Capitol or the White House or whatever, but also more specifically that the Roman Republic might fall and a new Caesar might emerge. And that has been a worry ever since the Roman Republic's existed. And I think that periodically that anxiety spikes and then it always goes down. So, American listeners worrying about the future of the American Republic, you're in very good company. People have been worrying about it for, 250 years.
So the most recent of your Roman Empire trilogy, while we're on the subject of Rome, was Pax, which I believe came out in 2023 and explored Rome in her pomp. Rome at the height of her reach and at the comparatively most peaceful part of her overall arc. I wanted to get, can we talk about the Pax Romana? I'm curious about the paradox which you draw out in your books about the extent to which Pax Romana, the Roman peace, relied on really quite a lot of violence.
So I think for us, peace tends to have slightly passive connotations, but for the Romans, it's a very active noun. It's something that you impose.
Pacification.
Yeah. So Pax, I mean, we translate it as peace, but it could equally be translated as pacification. And it's upheld by an absolute monopoly of violence, which is exercised by the Roman state, nominally by Caesar, but effectively by the apparatus that has evolved to govern the Roman Empire. But in the first and second centuries AD, if you live in the Mediterranean, you could spend your entire life and never run into a Roman legion. The legions are stationed along the frontier by and large. But it's the existence of the legions on the frontiers that enables the peace to be maintained. And the Roman state preserves the right, indeed the obligation, to essentially destroy anyone who threatens that peace, whether that's external enemies or whether it's rebels, outlaws, or whoever within the limits of the Roman Empire.
Hence Hadrian, he of the Wall, who I believe is the last major figure in Pax.
Yes. So it's unclear, actually. We're never told by a Roman source why Hadrian built his wall. There's this kind of vague sense he built it to separate the Romans from the barbarians.
He must have felt very strongly about it to put all of his people's effort in.
Well, I think people have the vague sense that he built it as a defensive structure. So there are, you know, particularly in the Victorian period, there were drawings of centurions striding along the wall and barbarians menacing the fortifications. But actually, the wall is not really broad enough to allow people to walk along. So I think the likelihood is that the wall was built as an expression of power and of contempt for those who lay beyond it. It was essentially saying to the Caledonians, so the people north of the wall, we don't need you with your deep-fried Mars bars and, you know, whatever. We reject you. You have no right to enter the great garden of the world that is the Roman Empire. And Hadrian does a similar thing along the kind of the lands just beyond the Rhine, where he builds a great wooden palisade. And he's saying the same thing to the German barbarians who lurk beyond that. And he builds a wall in along the southern limits of Africa, the province of Africa. So kind of guarding against the Sahara.
You think it's a sort of physical expression of thus far and no further?
So Hadrian was a great traveller, and he toured the limits of the empire, the Rhine, northern Britain, Africa, and so on. But he was also a great Philhellene. So he went to Greece a lot. He went to Athens. He went to Alexandria to visit these great centres of civilization, of peace, of intellect, of philosophy, so that he knew what it was to live in the heart of the garden. And so conversely, he knew what it was to build walls around that garden to keep the beggars and the riffraff out. So I think Hadrian's Wall is best thought of as the kind of electric gates of a gated community full of billionaires.
A very big gated community.
A very big one. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's what Rome's all about. It's an enormous empire. And the Roman, it's not a statement of the fact that the Romans are ceding their right to go and pulverize the people beyond the limits of the empire, or even to conquer if they want to. The guiding mission of Rome is summed up by Virgil, imperium sine fine, empire without limit. This is what the gods have given the Romans. But essentially what Hadrian is doing is saying, we don't really want it. It's not worth the effort. You beggars, you lie at the gates of our great garden, our great dominion, and we're not going to let you in because you're not worth it.
There's a sense in which, listening to you talk about the Romans, there's a sense in which anybody who's ever had big dreams about anything can find something that speaks to them in Rome. Whether it's people who want an analogy today for talking about border control, you know, there's Hadrian's Wall. If you want an analogy for your thousand-year empire of one kind or another, in theory, you can find that in Rome. In a sense, everybody can find a version of the Roman Empire which speaks to them, you know, and if they want to be anything other than, I don't know, just left alone.
I think that's true of people in what we might call the West. And in fact, one way perhaps to identify the West is, are you interested in the pre-Christian Roman Empire? Do you identify with it? Do you have a kind of interest in it? Because I don't think that's, I think, you know, people who live in the Orthodox world, for instance, are more interested in Byzantium, perhaps. And obviously beyond the Islamic world, a lot of which was also subject to the Roman Empire, they don't have any particular interest in it. They would look back to, you know, the golden age of the caliphate. But I think for people in the West, Rome is it's the great foundational state that is not quite foundational. So it is more like having a science fiction state parked in our past.
Because people talk about culturally, we're sort of, you know, we still have Athens and Jerusalem fighting in the sack. So where does Rome sit in relation to that?
I think Rome is simultaneously very familiar, so much more familiar than, say, ancient Greece is. Ancient Greece seems alien than Rome.
But at the same time,
it's fabulously weird and alien. And that's the key to great science fiction, it makes what is familiar seem strange, and it makes what is strange seem familiar. And I think that is, for us, is the fascination of Rome today. I think for people in earlier centuries, Rome also offered a model. The moment that the empire collapsed in the West, and of course it collapsed long before it did in the East and half, people wanted to start putting it back together again. So whether that was...
We must return.
The papacy. Yeah. So Gregory the Great sending missionaries to pagan Britain to Christianize Britain, because Britain had been part of the Roman Empire. He didn't bother sending missionaries to Ireland or to Saxony because they hadn't been part of the Roman Empire. So he wasn't going to bother with it. Charlemagne, of course, crowned as Caesar in Rome on Christmas Day in AD 800. And then a succession of would-be conquerors of Europe who have identified themselves with the Roman model. So whether that is Napoleon or indeed Mussolini or Hitler. But I think that the experience of fascism was so horrific for Europeans that essentially that...
It's been a sort of inoculation.
It's an inoculation. It's torched any sense of identification.
And yet somehow, not so much torched as the torch has been handed on, because the West is still alive and well. It's just that its centre of gravity has moved some considerable distance west across the Atlantic.
Yes.
And in a sense, Rome lives on in its science fiction form, perhaps you might say. And also in some much more substantial, you know, inspirational ways, you know, in the capital and so on.
I mean, I would say that France, for instance, compressed the entire history of Rome into about 30 years. So it had a revolution against the king. It introduced a republic. It had consuls. One of the consuls made himself an emperor. The empire ended up being defeated by Germans and other barbarians such as the British. And the whole history
That's
is
so
kind of
brutal.
Compressed into it.
Yep.
Whereas with the United States, it's still a republic. And so therefore, you know, Caesar has not yet crossed the Rubicon. Nero has not ascended the throne. The barbarians have not appeared on the limits of the Rhine. And so I think that there is a sense of identification in the United States that is still politically possible in a way that is not the case in Europe. Because, you know, we've had too many would-be Caesars in Europe, and we've seen where that has led.
Everyone's
no longer really politically sustainable for people to do that.
Yeah, that feels just about true now. Yeah, the bruises are still fairly palpable, and there are still people alive who remember how horrible it was last time.
Yeah.
And for at least as long as that continues, we're probably going to stay Caesar-free in Europe.
Yeah. Well, we've been inoculated, I think, for now against militarism and the kind of strut and excitement of autocracy.
Another theme that comes out very strongly in your discussion of the Roman Empire and the peace, that comes out in explorations of Rome, including in the contemporary way it's discussed in the American, in the West, as in the new center of gravity of the West in America, is the question of Rome and multiculturalism. I mean, a theme which crops up in the arguments that happen everywhere on the internet is the question of precisely those barbarians you mentioned at the various walls of the periphery of Hadrian's empire. He'd tore the edges and he'd put up walls and he'd say, you know, beyond this, you know, we're not interested and you lot can stay out and this is our nice gated community. And periodically you hear arguments about the contemporary world and wrestling with multiculturalism and some kind of a peaceful settlement across what is inevitably emerges in an empire, which is a plurality of cultures and customs held together through some kind of overarching governance structure, or set of principles or creeds. Now, do you think there are lessons that we could learn today from Rome's obviously for a long time very successful means of managing that kind of plurality?
So there was a tension, a very creative tension, literally from the beginning of the story of Rome, between the ideal of citizenship and the notion of Rome as a melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of being a citizen, cives, is at the heart of Roman civilization, because that is what civilization means. It means being a compound of citizens belonging to a city. The civic identity of the Roman people is fundamental to their success, the sense of being joined in a common polity. At the same time, the foundation myth of Rome is that this is a kind of collection of thieves, bandits, outlaws, immigrants, escapees who have gathered together on a place called the Asylum on the Capitol and then are kind of enrolled by Romulus as the citizens of the new city.
Mm-hmm.
And to the Greeks, for instance, it seemed inexplicable mm-hmm. that the Romans were as generous with their citizenship as they were.
Because the Greeks organised themselves into city-states, didn't they?
They did.
And it was a much more constrained and sort of modular.
So the two most famous city-states in Greece, Athens, the Athenians claimed to be autochthonous, that they had emerged literally from the soil. They were bred of the soil of Attica. And the Spartans, likewise, had a very restrictive notion of citizenship because it determined whether you were a free citizen or whether you were one of the slaves, the helots, who served the citizen. And in both cases, it was impossible for Athens and Sparta to grow in the way that Rome mm-hmm. grew, because over the course of its history, as it expanded beyond the limits of its immediate hinterland, as it started annexing territory across Italy, so the way in which it sustained its control over Italy was to give grants of citizenship to the elites that it had conquered, and then in due course, you know, all the various peoples of Italy. And in fact, in the first century BC, there was a war fought between the Italians and the Romans, and in a sense, the Italians were not fighting to be free of Rome, but to become Romans.
Mm.
And that is what duly happened.
Because some of the emperors from that height of Pax Romana made much, didn't they, of the fact that they weren't...
Yes.
They weren't from Rome.
Well,
Rome,
so
Rome.
So one of the most famous aristocratic dynasties in Rome, which gives its name to the Julio-Claudian house... slightly erroneously, because there was no such thing as a Julio-Claudian house, but the Claudians were a part of that kind of first ruling dynasty, and the Emperor Claudius is the most obvious example of that. The Claudians were immigrants. They were incredibly proud of this, and that is part of the foundational mythology of Rome. And again, that's something that parallels America, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's easier for Americans to kind of buy into that ideal mm-hmm. than perhaps if you are a country where the process of immigration happened much, much mm-hmm. earlier. And once Rome has started conquering the whole Mediterranean, the process by which people in Gaul and Spain and Africa and Greece and so on start to become Roman is incredibly quick, really.
Mm-hmm.
And by the beginning of the third century, you've got to a situation where every free male in the empire is granted citizenship.
Hmm.
But I think that in turn then generates a crisis, because fundamental to the Roman sense of why the empire exists is that the Roman people are the most, are the closest to the gods. Mm-hmm. They're the most obedient to the gods. They have the closest religio, the closest bond to the gods. And a religio can be a sacrifice or a priesthood or a feast day. And so the Romans, because they rule the world, self-evidently have the best religiones. But now that everyone is a Roman, what about people in Alexandria or Athens?
Because
or
their faith was
Londinian?
Very syncretic, wasn't it? At least until
really
Christianized.
A faith. It's not what you believe, it's what you do. It's the kind of insurance policy that you take out against fate. If you neglect the gods, if you offer them the wrong sacrifices, or you don't pay them the correct dues.
Right, because religio means sort of the done thing, doesn't it?
It's literally a bond. It's something that binds you to the mm-hmm. to the gods. So it's kind of an insurance policy. Mm-hmm. But if everyone now is a Roman citizen, how can you be sure that you have got the gods on your side if people in Antioch, are offering have different religiones to those in Rome? And so over the course of the 3rd century, which is a terrible period for Rome, barbarian invasions, plague, war with Persia on its eastern frontier, galloping inflation. There are seriously moments where it looks like the whole imperium is going to fall to pieces. Emperors are casting around for something that could perhaps, a single religio. And so Constantine, at the beginning of the 4th century, he's essentially auditioning a god that could preside over a single religio, and it could be the sun, or it could be Apollo, or it could be Hercules. And in the event, of course, famously, he decides that it's going to be Christ.
So Gibbon thought that, well, he said something to the effect that Rome survived as long as it remained pagan. And he took the view that Christianity was the beginning of the end. Do you think he's putting the cart before the horse?
I think he has it exactly the wrong way around.
I think he's got it backwards.
Exactly the wrong way around. I think that the great achievement of the Roman Empire in late antiquity is to find a kind of cement that enables this fracturing order to be held together. Mm-hmm. And the ideological cement is provided by Christianity, because Christianity provides a universal God for a universal empire.
That's the extraordinary innovation of Christianity, isn't it? Is this sense of universalism, that message that comes through that really the Holy Spirit is for everyone. And that's a very radical thought at the time.
And that the emperor can serve as a kind of image of the Christian God. Mm-hmm. That the Christian God could be thought of perhaps as a paterfamilias, the head of a Roman family, God the Father. There's something there for the Roman state to play with. And it is hugely influential. I think it inspires the Persian Empire, the Sasanian Empire, to structure the kind of the slightly inchoate Zoroastrian order that had existed there, this notion of the world being divided into rival forces of good and evil. It was very ancient, but it gets solidified and formalized by the Sasanian emperors, I think inspired by the Roman example, so that by late antiquity, so the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, you have a kind of Zoroastrian equivalent of the Christian church as it's functioning in the Roman Empire. And then the Persian Empire collapses and the Roman Empire is severely truncated by Arab conquests. And the Arabs, when they construct their empire, likewise construct a kind of an ideology that provides an even more authoritarian form of God in the form of Islam,
and it's still
going strong.
That's right. So it's actually a
brilliant way of constructing a kind of common sense of identity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll come back to Christianity, which of course you literally wrote the book on.
Isn't that the Bible?
Well, yeah, you wrote a book that a great many people have read. So we'll come back to that. But I just want to stick a pin in the Persians and the Arab world, because it feels to me as though this is a theme which somehow which can sort of fall off the map in the world as it currently is. And you wrote a book on the quarrel between the Greeks and the Persians, and another In the Shadow of the Sword on the early history of Islam. Yeah. And I wondered, do you have a sense that our feeling for the contribution of the Persian and the Islamic worlds to our contemporary culture in the West has maybe fallen away somewhat, perhaps particularly as the centre of gravity of the West has moved west?
I think that people in the West have always underplayed the massive significance of Persia.
Mm-hmm.
I think Persia is like this huge underground spring from which so many streams and rivers have flowed. It's enormously influential. But because right from the time of Herodotus, he literally writes the first history, and his opening paragraph, he's talking about, he's going to write about the great war between the Greeks and the Persians, or Europe and Asia, as he describes it. That sense of a kind of binary is, it's been there right from the beginning. Even though Herodotus himself was fascinated by Persia and was very respectful of everything that they represented, actually, even as he kind of describes their defeat at the hands of the Greeks. But I think that the influence of Persia on the way we conceptualize the world is stupendous. So the kind of very obvious one is the notion of time as being an arrow rather than a cycle. The idea of there
that
being
comes from Persia.
A beginning and an end. This is essentially there in what you might call Zoroastrianism. I mean, I think it's probably anachronistic to call it Zoroastrianism early on, kind of Mazdaism, whatever.
Mm.
But that, yes, that idea of there being a beginning and then a day of judgment.
Because, I mean, I was familiar with that as being an innovation of Christian theology.
No,
Christians.
And indeed, the Hebrew scriptures. So it's there in the book of Daniel.
Mm.
It's clearly deriving from the influence of Persian thought. The Judean exiles are picking it up, and then it gets into the bloodstream of the Judeans, and from Judea it passes into Christianity, and then from the kind of the melting pot of late antique culture, it passes into Islam as well.
So the deep history of progress is actually
Persia. Yeah, absolutely. So that's Persia. But also the idea of the cosmos being moralized, the idea of there being good and evil, light and darkness, truth and lie. This is a Persian conceptualization as well, which again has a massive influence on what will become the Bible. And therefore Christianity and Islam again. And none of this would have happened without Persia. And actually what made me interested in writing about the great empires of late antiquity was an inscription by Darius the Great. So he is, the Persian Empire is founded by Cyrus the Great, and then there's a kind of civil war and Darius emerges from it. And he wrote this great inscription in a place called Bisatun, which is on the road that winds up from the mudflats of Mesopotamia up onto the plateau of Iran. And in it, he describes a war that he fights against the Elamites, and the Elamites keep rebelling. And he ends up condemning the Elamites, not just for their rebellion, but for the fact that they're worshipping the wrong gods, that they're worshipping darkness rather than light. And he tells the troops that he's sending to fight the Elamites that if you fall in battle against these Elamites, you are on the side of light. Your reward will basically be in heaven. And you can see there, that is a kind of acorn from which crusades and jihads will emerge.
Yep. And in a sense, also return.
Yeah. And that was the book I wrote on that Persian fire was written against the backdrop of the war on terror and the invasion, George Bush's invasion of Iraq, in which the Americans very much cast themselves as the heirs of Athens. So there were quite a lot of ideologues in the Bush administration that very consciously compared themselves, say, to Athens.
Mm.
But I think you could... There's at least as good a comparison with Persia, because the Persians, when they attacked Athens, they saw themselves as attacking savages in a kind of remote, mountainous backwater, distant from the centers of civilization, where people had launched terrorist attacks and they had to be punished. You know, it was, if you like, a kind of war on terror. And that notion of the world, you know, an axis of good and evil, that's pure masterism.
That's
the kind of thing that the Persians were coming out with all the time in their inscriptions, and you tend not to get in, say, Herodotus.
So is there a sense that the reason we generally think of the story from the Greeks' point of view, is that just, do you think that's just a quirk of historiography and the accounts that we're more likely to read or the more likely to come across?
I think fundamentally... I think if there'd been a Persian Herodotus, and, you know, Herodotus was a subject of the Persian king. I mean, he was born in Halicarnassus, which was a city had been subject to the Persian king. But obviously he's a Greek speaker, so he identifies with the Greeks. But I think had there been a Persian who wrote a history of the order that Herodotus wrote, then of course we would.
Yeah.
And part of the problem with escaping the Greek perspective is precisely that the Persians did abstract everything. So that inscription at Bisatun, Darius's inscription, that's the exception that proves the rule, because essentially Darius was a usurper.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to justify his rule by demonstrating that when he had toppled the legitimate king and usurped the throne, actually, he, Darius, was on the side of truth, and that the guy he's toppled was on the side of the lie, and he's protesting too much. But that's why he has to do it. But from that point on, the Persian kings are abstracting themselves into images of truth.
Mm-hmm.
Their enemies are agents of the lie. They are agents of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't need to provide kind of detailed accounts of what they're doing, because it's all dissolved into this notion of the great war between
darkness and light.
And darkness that animates the entire cosmos.
Mm-hmm. And the king is by definition on the side of the light, so whatever.
Exactly. So you don't need to have, you know, detailed accounts of the Battle of Thermopylae, for instance. And this is why, I mean, it's, you will often see people say, oh, what's with this obsession with the Greeks and the Romans? It's obviously because they're European, and people, it's very Eurocentric, and why can't we be more interested in the Persians or the Egyptians? The reason is that the Persians and the Egyptians did not write interesting and entertaining histories. That give us a story. And ultimately, it doesn't matter how many pyramids or statues of pharaohs or friezes from Persepolis that you look at, they're not as fun to read about as Herodotus's account of Thermopylae or Suetonius's account of the sex life of Caligula.
And yet, my sense is also that the Middle East and the Islamic world sort of intermingled with the late antiquity and early medieval worlds much more freely than is perhaps understood now. I mean, I'm thinking about the Arab commentaries on Aristotle, for example, which kept Greek philosophy alive.
I mean, I think
over a time when he was more or less lost in Europe, for example.
Yeah, well, it's kind of amazing that the Ayatollah Khomeini, his specialization was Greek philosophy.
That's right.
And particularly Plato.
Mm-hmm.
And Plato's model of the Republic with, you know, guardians who are entrusted with the governance of the Republic. That notion, Islamized, becomes the kind
That's
of
right.
the foundation for the ideology that still governs
and
the
I
Islamic
really
Republic to this day.
I find it fascinating, for example, that the first teaching institution in anything like the form of the modern university preceded any of the European universities by, was it a century, the one at Fes?
I'm not sure that's true.
Is it not? You can correct me.
I mean, I think that the idea of there being academies where you might be instructed, you might go to profit and learn, is they're actually there with Plato, the Plato's Academy. Mm-hmm. And there are madrasas and there are monasteries and there are kind of schools.
But the monasteries and universities are not quite the same kind of institution.
No. So I think the university is, as it exists today in the modern world, is bred specifically of 12th century Europe.
That's right.
And this great ideological convulsion that happens over the course of the 11th and the 12th century, and which gives birth to canon law and to the notion of human rights and ultimately to the university as we understand mm-hmm. it today. And it was exported around the world in the colonial period. And the prestige now of the United States means that it is something that non-Christian societies mm-hmm. want to emulate. But I think there's a very clear derivation from the universities that emerge in the 12th century, Bologna and, mm-hmm. and Paris and Oxford.
Hmm. We've now been subtweeting Christianity for a few minutes without coming at it directly. But I think of the books that you've written in recent years, the one I've seen cited against your name most frequently has to be Dominion. I mean, we've been talking about Rome and Persia and the Islamic world, but Dominion is Tom Holland's Dominion is the phrase that forever pops up, because it's been phenomenally influential in contemporary conversations, in bringing Christianity back to people's awareness, not as something which happened, but as something which is happening, which happened and is still happening.
Yes, I think I think Greece and Rome, obviously, I think they are fascinating, and they have, you know, I write about them because I think they're interesting, and I hope that people who read my books on Greece and Rome would share my sense of fascination with them and recognize that they are incredibly interesting. But I don't think they're interesting necessarily because they make us understand ourselves in the present day better. I mean, they might do by point of comparison or analogy or whatever, but it's not like, oh, you should study the institution of the consulship because it underlies, I don't know, the American presidency or something. That's clearly not true. It's like
studying someone's family tree as opposed to studying your own, perhaps.
Well, a kind of very distant ancestor, perhaps. But I remember, so the first book I wrote was about the Roman Republic, and I wrote lots of articles about that because it was against the backdrop of the Iraq War, and so I comparisons between the American Republic and the mm-hmm. American, you know, I did loads and loads of those, and it generated no controversy, no kind of kickback at all. People just thought that was quite interesting. And then with the Greeks, I wrote about the Greeks and I wrote about the ancient Persians, and again, you know, saying, oh, these are really interesting and maybe there are parallels here and stuff, but again, nobody felt strongly enough about it to kick back. And then I wrote a book about the 11th century and saying that this is the great turning point where what had been a kind of ancient way of understanding the world becomes something recognizably from which we in the West today are descended. And it's fundamentally all about Christian theology. Yep. And the revolution is a papal revolution. And the popes of the 11th century are the first great mm-hmm. revolutionaries. And I wrote this up as a kind of publicity piece mm-hmm. in The New Statesman. Which is a magazine of the left here, mm-hmm. and assumed that it would be, you know, people would just say, okay, well, here's a bloke publicising a book. And it generated fury. And yeah. The editor said, we've never had so many irate yeah. letters about something. And I was astonished because I just thought, well, it's an interesting argument about the 11th century. And I realised actually that arguments about Christianity, of course, are much more live than mm-hmm. arguments about Roman imperialism or Greek philosophy or whatever, right. because they matter. They do still massively matter much more.
They do.
And so that alerted me to the fact that Christianity might seem to be in this, you know, God might seem dead, but actually God isn't dead.
No,
and Christianity's not dead. And this is still something that is animating debate here. And so I wrote that, I think, around 2010 or something. And so from that point on, I was thinking, well, perhaps I should stress test the thesis of this book, Millennium, that actually the 11th century is this great turning point. If it is, I should try and trace what led to it and where it led. And so that ultimately was what Dominion was. But I then had kind of 10 years to reflect on it before coming to write that book.
Yeah, I read Dominion against Larry Siedentop's book on Inventing the Individual, which also converges, I think, very convincingly on roughly the same period as being such a ferment
thematically. He wrote to me after I wrote Millennium, and he was writing that.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd written a short essay, I think, about the nature of Europe or something. Mm-hmm. And so we met and we talked about it quite a lot while both of us were writing those books. And I included Inventing the Individual, obviously, in my bibliography because it came out before Dominion did. And Dominion was so long that I was asked by my editor to cut back on the bibliography. And so I put a list of the most important books and I set it aside, and then I went through all the others, kind of working it out. And then I forgot to send it to the editor. So it came out without this list of the key books.
Oh, no.
And I was so mortified by it.
And yet there it is. I mean, you can feel the presence of the two books in
well,
one it, another.
It, both books, I think, were a product of our conversations. And I felt terrible that I hadn't acknowledged the impact that my conversations with Larry
had. Well, I also think there's something, when we're talking about, Chris, you say you'd inadvertently opened a can of worms by talking about the middle bit, particularly the 11th century. And there's something really interesting that I've noticed in, particularly in histories of ideas. I mean, historians of history is a slightly different thing, but histories of ideas, it's very noticeable and it's quite striking, actually, once you start seeing it, how often people will skip straight from classical Greece and possibly Rome at a pinch, all the way straight to the Renaissance.
Or the Enlightenment.
So there was
very notorious... It was a European constitution, I think, that was being drawn up in the 2000s. And it said Europe is a civilization that derives from Greece and Rome and is animated by the principles of the Enlightenment.
That's right. Greece and Rome and the French Revolution. And there's some stuff.
I think it was the Enlightenment.
Right.
And obviously those three were included because basically nobody really cared about Greece or Rome, so you could say what you like about them. And the Enlightenment, people basically thought, yeah, everyone loves the Enlightenment.
So why do you think it's so difficult for people to think about the middle bit, which is of course your entire, is your principal area of, why is that so difficult?
Well,
I think
two reasons. I think because it's very ideologically contested, because the great revolution in the 11th century, the Papal Revolution, enshrines the idea of not just individual baptism, but a kind of baptism for an entire people.
Am I right that this is the point where the Great Schism happened as well, more or less?
Yes, because this is a revolutionary society that is rejecting all kinds of things, which would include the right of emperors to lay their grubby fingers on the radiant white purity of the robes of the church. Therefore, the church embodies the dimension of religio, which is the bond that joins the church to the eternity of heaven, as opposed to the dimension of the saeculum, which is the churn of life and death to which earthly kings belong and earthly emperors. And so they divide this out, and it enshrines this completely revolutionary notion of what comes to be called religion and the secular, which simply had not existed before, and now is so fundamental to our way of thinking that we find it almost impossible to conceive of a way of conceptualizing existence that doesn't contain it. And so that's a kind of perfect example of how radical this revolution was, and why we have completely forgotten it, because it's been completely successful. it's revolutions that don't entirely succeed that we remember, but by almost by definition, a successful revolution tends to be forgotten because we internalize its results. Mm. And one of the ways in which this revolution manifests itself in the lives of Christian people over the course of the High Middle Ages is that there are lots of people who reject it. So you might call them deplorables, people who are left behind. So the Albigensian Crusade, they're often described as, you know, the people who are attacked.
They were more sort of slaughtered by Knights Templar than left behind, were they not?
Well, they're destroyed. They're attacked by Crusaders. Mm. And tradition, you know, the way that it's normally told is that these are Cathars, people who worship a dualist god and all kinds. This is not the case. This is a fantasy of the Inquisitors who come in to kind of try and purify people's minds after the Crusade. But actually, the Albigensians are simply Christians practicing the kind of Christianity that has been left behind by this revolutionary order. So they are people who don't want to subscribe to the notion of reformatio, of progress, of change, and therefore have to be eliminated. Equally, in this revolutionary order, there are people who feel that the revolution hasn't gone far enough, or that it's calcifying, or that, you know, yesterday's revolutionary is now today's reactionary. And in the long run, this then generates another reformatio, which we call the Reformation. And then the Reformation in turn generates another one, which we might call the Enlightenment. It generates the French Revolution, and so on and so on and so on. So there's a kind of endless churn. And it means that Catholics are resentful of Protestants. Protestants are resentful of secularists. In France, it's, you know, tension between Catholics and Republicans. It's too politically contested. Mm. You cannot put it in. What will Protestants say? What will secularists say? What will atheists say? They're all a product of this great process of kind of this churn, this kind of this recycling of the radically Western Christian notion of reformatio, of remaking
society.
So do you
think it's just revolutions all the way down?
Yes,
from,
I do.
From here?
I do. I think it's it's like living in Western Christendom has been like building a San Francisco on the San Andreas Fault. Mm. There are endless convulsions and tremors, and we're living through identical process at the moment. So I think that's one reason. I think the other reason is that over the course of the common market and then the European Union's existence, Europe has become multi-faith in a way that it simply wasn't before. Mm. I mean, you know, there were Jews, and that was pretty much it. Otherwise, everyone was Christian or ideologically descended from Christians. Mm. But now that there are kind of large numbers of Muslims, there are Hindus, there are Sikhs, whatever, kind of going on about Christianity and the role that Christianity has played in shaping Christian civilization makes it harder for secularists to pretend that the secular is a neutral notion.
Right.
You cannot have a secular. I mean, and essentially, the way that a multicultural society works in the West depends on people who have particular kind of relationships to the supernatural, let's mm-hmm. put it like that, conceptualizing themselves as belonging to a religion. Mm-hmm. And to do that is to Christianize yourself, because the notion
That's
of religion
right.
is a Christian notion, and it exists in the context of the secular, which is also derives from Christian thought and history. But if you draw people's attention to that, then it immediately incinerates the conceit of secularism, which is that it is neutral.
Okay.
Because it clearly isn't. And so therefore, again, you cannot draw attention to the Christian nature of the secular, because that kind of blows up the whole kind of ideological framework.
So towards the end of Dominion, you draw a line in some of the concluding chapters between this long arc of the development of Christian civilization up to, I believe one of the last chapters is titled Woke or something, or was
yeah.
something to that effect. So I'm curious, Woke sort of had a very potent moment, roughly concurrent with COVID, and the discourse, has it moved on? Has it not moved on? Is there anything that you would say differently if you were writing the book now?
Literally nothing.
Nothing at all. You still think it's the same pattern?
I would absolutely include, I think, Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I would probably also include a little bit more about the trans issue.
Mm. So another question on related themes. If you think it's revolutions all the way down, and is it, in your view, does it follow from that they necessarily have to be revolutions all in the same direction? I mean, in this, as
no,
part of this...
No, because the Reformation generates a counter-reformation.
I suppose you can. As part of this series, I spoke to Justin Brierley, who included extensive discussion of your work, Dominion, in a recent book of his, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. I don't think he cites you as a Christian intellectual, but as an intellectual who takes an interest in Christian faith. And it's his view that we're heading back in the other direction towards a revival of Christian belief in the previously extremely secular seeming West. What do you think about that? Do you think that's overly hopeful? Do you think that's happening? What's your sense?
Well, I think that we've had 1,000 years of living in this kind of revolutionary society that was bred by the Papal Revolution. You know, that's the primal, I suppose ultimately the primal earthquake is Paul's letters and the Gospels. But in the context, I mean, Western Christendom is very distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's in the 11th century that it clearly takes a direction that separates it, say, from the Orthodox world. And so that's why you have the schism between Constantinople and Rome in the 11th century. And ever since then, there have been kind of more and more takes on it because hardwired into the revolution, the notion of revolution that we've inherited is a drive for purity.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the great papal revolutionaries were about. That's why they forced the emperor to kneel in the snow at Canossa. It's about purifying what has been filthy and grubby and dirty. And the same desire is there in the Protestant Reformation, it's there in the French Revolution, and it's with us now, today. And that drive to for purity, for virtue, is sped up the better the media is.
Mm-hmm.
So famously, the printing press propels the Reformation. The French Revolution is driven by the ready availability of pamphlets.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're living through now has been massively accelerated by the fact that everyone's online, kind of looking at social media and whatever.
What do you make of the Marshall McLuhan view on the idea that the media we consume, in a sense, transform the way we think and transform the way we relate to the world, sometimes much more radically than we think? So it's not just a method of information transmission, that in a sense the way we process and transmit information is part of the message itself.
I think it's palpably true. I mean, you only have to look at how Luther's Reformation was spread by his mastery of the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
Or look at how the removal of censorship in the 1650s in England, after the execution of the king and the establishment of a republic, turbocharged new ways of being Christian.
That's right.
So
that's
the Quakers
right.
or the
One of the quirkiest lines of argument on this theme that I've been exploring recently is the relationship between medieval culture and memory. I've been reading Mary Carruthers' study from the, I think it's the 1990s, she wrote a book on the medieval memory cultures, which emerged out of a world in which texts were simply not as readily available as they were after the printing press. And she shows that the practice of memorization and the depth and colourfulness of memorization formed an entire culture in a way which is actually very opaque to us now, because obviously they didn't write it down, sort of by definition. And so it died with them. And one of the ideas I've been playing with with is that part of Reformation iconoclasm happened as downstream of a kind of mental iconoclasm after people no longer needed to build memory palaces in the same way as they had in the medieval era, simply because there were more texts and people could afford to own their own libraries. And so people were able to write things down to a far greater extent, and as that accelerated. So they didn't have these colourful palaces of the mind anymore, and iconoclasm of the kind which then turbocharged the Reformation, and this, and again, these drives for purification that you're talking about, and this idea of a new, purer, more less ornate relationship just immediately with God comes to be thinkable for the first time.
Yes, I think that a religion of the book requires, you need ways to propagate it.
That's right. I mean, of course, your 11th century, again, that's roughly concurrent with the spread of the Codex.
Yeah, well,
isn't it?
In
Western Europe.
It's a little bit before that. So in the Carolingian period, you also have a simplification of the script, mm-hmm. to make it more legible,
right.
to make it more easily readable.
Mm-hmm.
And that is done because Christian leaders are worried that people out in the fields or whatever are not learning what they need to learn to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
And that expedites a great program of literacy through the Middle Ages, but it also expedites the great efflorescence of cathedrals and churches.
Mm.
I mean, we're so habituated to the existence of cathedrals, yep. I think, in Europe.
We forget how extraordinary they are.
Forget how extraordinary it is. Lincoln Cathedral, the first building to be higher than the Great Pyramid ever. And then, you know, it's falls down, but I mean these are mad structures to be built, but in a way it's about making manifest,
mm-hmm.
the truths of God in ways that will blow people away,
mm.
and you have the site of the, you know, these great stone structures, but mm-hmm. then inside you have sculpture and glass and icons and things that enable people to access it.
So the entire building is a book of memory.
Yes, yep. Yes. And then once you have the printing press and it becomes more easy to access, then it becomes, you know, it's democratized.
Yeah.
And so people can start coming up with their own ways of thinking,
mm-hmm.
about,
mm-hmm.
it. And I've talked about the, you know, Luther's pamphlets, but I think what's also crucial to this is hymns.
Mm.
You know, his hymns, the music, yes. of the Protestant Reformation.
Yes.
The Protestants are a hymn-singing,
mm-hmm.
hymn-singing Christians.
That's right.
And the music also is a way of propagating ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so a new book that I'm literally meant to be starting next week, I'm looking at the 60s as a decade in which something similar happens, because the transistor radio, mm-hmm. means that similar messages can be conveyed through popular music.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be called All You Need Is Love,
mm-hmm.
because a song that is as listened to, mm-hmm. as a song by the Beatles is listened to in the 60s is perfectly attuned to reducing the immense complexities,
mm-hmm.
of scripture,
mm-hmm.
into a kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are, I think, now. I think
we're living in John Lennon's Imagine,
the world of the vibe.
That's right. That's right. So just looping this back to the Internet revolution, which it seems to me, I mean, this is my thesis, really, that we completed our transition to being a digital first culture roughly concurrently with COVID, because that just forced even people who didn't particularly like the Internet into using it. And culture has changed irrevocably, I think, in the wake of that. You know, politics is different. All manner of things have gone weird downstream of that.
I mean, a personal example for me is that up until 2021, my primary job was to write books, to sit and write books, even though I was kind of typing it. But since then, what I chiefly do is to do podcasts.
That's right.
Which would have been unthinkable before, really. I mean, it wouldn't cross my mind even that you would do that. And it now takes up so much of my time that I'm finding it, you know, I meant to be writing this book about the 60s for about 3 years, and I just can't find the time. So it's taking a real effort.
I want to talk about the rest is history, which I love. I think there's something, part of what's magical about it is the relationship between you and your co-host Dominic Sandbrook. But also the other thing which I think is so powerful and so popular about it is the capacity the two of you have for storytelling. And I wanted to ask you about storytelling, because it seems to me this is really one of your superpowers as an historian, your gift for bringing a kind of imaginative colour to, as well as a mastery of the sources. I think Lyotard talked about the postmodern condition as being suspicion towards metanarratives. Mm. And it seems to me as though academic history has devolved in one direction into a kind of perpetual attitude of critique. So we must problematize everything. And we are only able to look at the past through the lens of, you know, one form of oppression or another, or this stance of perpetual critique. Or critiquing itself if it runs out of things to critique, and then on the other hand, into ever decreasing silos, you know, sort of the minutiae. So people burrowing away in archives, and, you know, writing an entire PhD on one shoelace, or I don't know, or, you know, and so it seems to me that somewhere falling between those two stools is a capacity to tell stories about the past that are both true and also still stories.
I think that telling narration, which is how history begins.
Narration is a better word than storytelling, I think.
Herodotus tells, you know, he's basically interested in everything. He's slaloming around all over the place. It takes him a long time to get to the narrative of the Persian invasions of Greece. And even when he does, he's still, you know, going off piste all the time. But it begins with his desire to tell a story. That's what he says in his opening paragraph. Mm-hmm. I'm going to explain how and why the Greeks and the Persians came to war and what happened. Mm-hmm. And that's what he does. So that's what gives birth to history, because it's about applying the standards of rationalism that is simultaneously giving birth to all kinds of things in Ionia to events in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think we are now so much Herodotus' heirs that we don't realize how radical and profound and mad that is. No one had really done it before. You know, we talked about the Persians and the Egyptians. They see no need to kind of order the past in that sense, to kind of impose that pattern on the events of the past. But we do, and we're its heirs. And I think we can run the risk perhaps of taking it for granted, because I think what narrative does when applied to the past is to remind us of contingency. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, it's been a trend in academia for a long time to try and find ways that explain what happened. So whether it's Marxism or Catholicism or whatever, some kind of overarching theory. And the contemporary one could be intersectionality, the idea that, you know, or Foucault or whatever, the idea that it's all about exploitation or whatever, and fundamentally that is the skeleton key that unlocks everything. But I don't think that the churn and chaos and confusion of being human allows for those kind of skeleton keys. I think that what history teaches you is fundamentally how many different ways there are and have been to be human, and that the best way to understand that is to look at how people in the past behaved, what they did, and what the consequences of that were. And that is what narrative gives you. So I think it's incredibly valuable. And I think also, of course, it's just incredibly interesting. It makes it much more fun. And that's why I think the rest of history is successful, is because everyone loves a story.
Everyone loves a story.
I also think that specifically from my point of view, and when I think of the books that I've written, I think I've always been particularly interested in ancient or early medieval history, because the sense there of the ordering of the past is so literary. Mm-hmm. So Herodotus is a great literary writer. Tacitus is a great literary writer. The lives of the saints are modelled on biblical archetypes. And that means that the literary quality of history is something that can be embedded into a retelling of the past.
Mm.
And you're paying homage to the way that the people you're writing about conceptualized the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I make no apologies for thinking that narrative history is incredibly valuable.
Well, and nor should you. But perhaps you can help me settle an argument that I have with an historian friend who now works in politics, who takes the view that it's possible to tell neutral tell neutral histories. When, you know, having expressed some suspicion towards postmodernists a moment ago, I actually take the slightly more postmodern view that I'm not completely convinced that it is possible to tell a story without it, in a sense, you know, if it's going from somewhere to somewhere, it will inevitably include some things and leave other things out.
Of course, and the language that you use. So if you use right. English, you're using words that are shaped by by the history mm-hmm. of the people who've spoken that language.
So I
and that was one of the things that made me want to write Dominion, mm-hmm. was realizing, writing about the pre-Christian world mm-hmm. and discovering that words like religion and secular mm-hmm. and homosexual or whatever
are not in fact self-explanatory at all.
Well, but they're anachronistic. If you use the word right. secular or mm-hmm. religion, you talk about Greek religion, ancient Greek religion,
yep.
that's a massive anachronism. Mm-hmm. And realizing that, you know, English is not a neutral language. So, mm-hmm. no, I don't think you can. But I think what you can do is to recognize that history has often, you know, the events of history,
mm-hmm.
the moments that we record and recall
mm-hmm.
have often been generated by the interaction of people who have very different perspectives and takes.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be the history of politics, mm-hmm. where, you know, we began by talking about the Romans. The Romans. Mm-hmm. You know.
Which Romans?
The Romans. I mean, what period are we talking about? Are we, you know, are we talking about Caesar or Cato? Are we talking about Cicero or Augustus? You know, there's a multiplicity of different mm-hmm. perspectives. Or kind of, you know, the Cortez and Moctezuma. These are totally different worlds,
mm-hmm.
and it's mad to say, well, obviously, you know, the Aztecs are the goodies, the Spanish are the baddies, or vice versa. I mean, both sides think they're the goodies, and both sides fall short mm-hmm. of the ideals that they have. And what's interesting is to see the try to do your best to see the world as Cortez and his Spanish see it,
yes,
or Moctezuma and yes. and the Aztecs see it.
Mm-hmm.
But recognizing that even among the Spaniards, Cortez and Las Casas are completely different. One is a conquistador, one becomes, you know, the great spokesman for the human rights of, mm. of the Native Americans. That there is always a multiplicity of perspectives, because even to be an individual human is not to have stable perspectives. They will always be shifting. And mm. so if that's the case, it must be true of the vast sum of humanity in total.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the great thing about history, is it enables you to sense that multiplicity, mm. that range,
mm-hmm.
that complexity of what it is to be human.
I think that's absolutely right. So I'm sure I'm hesitant to ask you to speculate too much about the present as an historian, but I can't resist one question. Since you write so richly about empires past, now there's been a lot of conversation in more recent months and years about coming out of the other end of perhaps of the post-war settlement. I mean, we began by thinking a little bit about that post-war settlement and the inoculation that it gave us. There's been some discussion about the possibility of coming out the other end of the post-war settlement and the rules-based international order into, and I quote from a new age of empires is the dread phrase that gets sloshed around. Do you think that's overblown? Do you think that's a possibility? I mean, what's your?
I think it's completely a possibility, because I think the idea of there being human rights is as fantastical as believing that the Lord Jesus rose from the dead on the third day.
Hmm.
But the entire ideological apparatus of the Western world, for as long as I've been conscious,
mm-hmm.
has been founded on that.
Mm-hmm.
And even when those ideals were kind of ignored or, you know, cynically distorted, people still kind of in their hearts believed them.
Mm-hmm.
But all it takes is someone to say, well, the emperor has no clothes. And suddenly people start looking around and worrying that perhaps they're naked. And once that's gone, then who knows where you'll go? And all it takes, for as long as I've been alive, the role of an American president was to balance the raw naked quality of American supremacy
mm-hmm.
with this guiding ideology. And it generated massive hypocrisy. But I think I prefer American presidents to be hypocritical than to be nakedly, devotees of raw power. But once you have an American president who say, oh, it's all rubbish, I'm America's top nation, we can do what we like, then it kind of blows the whole thing away. And actually, it slightly reminds me of, throughout the Middle Ages, which we've been talking about, the monasteries exist and they're incredibly rich.
Mm-hmm.
They have all kinds of land and property, and they're seen as playing this crucial role in the spiritual life of Christians. And it's just an absolute taboo
mm-hmm.
to contemplate that perhaps you could just nick everything they've got
and then Henry
and pocket it. And then Henry VIII comes along and does it, and everyone goes, "Wow, brilliant!" And of course, there are still people who think the monastery, it's a terrible tragedy that the monasteries were despoiled and dissolved, but we're not going back. We need to construct a new...
That's right.
I mean, humans cannot exist without ideological
mm-hmm.
frameworks and myths and stories. And, we're never... It's never about a kind of pure, amoral materialism.
I think
we cannot function. There is no society that's been like that.
Occasionally people try, but they're always...
We've always had fantasies.
Occasionally people try, but they're always unbelievably depressed people.
Yeah. But I think, I think so. So new fantasies, new ideals, new faiths will emerge. But I think we are living through the death throes of a particular form of post-Christian idealism that emerged in the wake of the Second World War, in which the Nazis played the role of the devil and the Christian notion of human rights was kind of universalized
mm-hmm.
so that when... people from Western countries talk to the Chinese, it wouldn't be immediately obvious that we were proselytizing in a Christian way, which is essentially what we were doing.
That's right. So where do you see grounds for optimism in the world as it now is? I mean, assuming you do.
Dentistry.
I couldn't agree more, actually. Occasionally I'm swearing at my phone or complaining about the trains being late. And I think, there are lots of things about the modern world that are rubbish, but I wouldn't do without modern dentistry and modern obstetrics. I wouldn't be here without the latter.
No.
Among many other things, actually.
Well, I thought during the pandemic, the kind of sheer terror that people felt at the thought that there was this virus that might... that could kill you and that there wasn't any way that you could stop it happening. And it took us back to the world, that existed not that long ago, where you cut yourself and you might die. You might go into labour and you'd probably die. All kinds of awful things would endlessly be happening. And people just lived with that. The loss of children, the loss of wives, and we don't have that anymore. And COVID, I think, should have reminded us of how blessed we are to live in a world where it was the exception that proved the rule. And that rule is an immense positive.
Well, long may that continue.
Yeah, I know.
Long may that continue.
Hopefully.
So when can we look forward to seeing your book on the 1960s and the pop song? And imagine.
I'm hoping I've cleared enough time to start it next week, but I probably won't finish it until, 2037 or something.
Well, all power to your pen. Tom, it's been such a privilege to speak to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me, Mary Harrington. This is Socrates Dialogues. Stay tuned for the next episode. You might be thinking, that's not Eric Metaxas. My name's Mary Harrington, I'm a writer and a past contributor to Socrates in the City. I'm thrilled to be joining Socrates in the City as the first inaugural Socrates contributor. Throughout 2026, I'll be hosting many fascinating conversations on life, God, and other small topics. Be sure to subscribe to get notifications whenever a new episode from Eric or myself drops. And thank you for tuning in.